Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of March. The U.S. Supreme Court, just moments from now, will take up its first serious look at the issue of same-sex marriage. They will be considering two cases during the next 2 days, one from California, and will ask, does the Constitution guarantee of equal protection allow legal distinctions between same-sex couples and those of the opposite sex? It looks as though the potential for a ruling that would have large nationwide implication comes from that California case. Tomorrow, there will be hearings on the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. We're going to be talking about both of the hearings, public opinion, where the justices stand. It's a historic day at the Supreme Court, and joining us is Jane Schachter. She is a leading expert on statutory interpretation and legislative process, constitutional law, and sexual orientation law. She is a professor of law and associate dean for curriculum at Stanford Law School. We welcome your phone calls, and here is how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll keep track of what's going on in terms of oral arguments during the course of this hour, let you know when they start and generally what is being said. A historic day in Washington, and we're delighted to talk about it this hour of the program. Professor Schachter, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning to you. Let's just start with public opinion increasingly in favor of same-sex marriage. Does that factor into the justices' consideration of these issues?
You know, it's a great question. I think it does, but not in the way that people might think. It's certainly not the case, in my view, that the justices check the polls before they decide how to vote. But what's happened over the last, say, 20 years, since 1993, when the Hawaii Supreme Court really started this whole ball rolling by issuing a ruling in which it looked like it was about to legalize same-sex marriage. It didn't, but it looked like it was about to. What's happened over that period of time is that public opinion has changed very rapidly, really in the last 5 or 6 or 8 years mostly, in favor of same-sex marriage. And the way I think that affects the justices is this. The core question for them in both of these cases is there a good reason for the government to draw the line where it's drawn the line? It's drawn the line between same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples, and it said some can marry and have access to a central institution in society, others can't. And when a line like that is constitutionally challenged, it falls on the government to say why it has drawn the line. And I think the reason that the government is giving once looked eminently reasonable, almost like a slam dunk. And what's happened over time, as public opinion has shifted and people, including the justices themselves, have gotten used to the idea of same-sex marriage, it starts to look less reasonable. More like it might be bias or unfamiliarity or discomfort or something that raises constitutional red flags.
And can you just weigh in for a moment as to why public opinion has shifted? It would appear to be fairly rapidly.
Yeah, it's really something. I think one is hard-pressed to find an area of social change where the change has been quite this rapid. Let's remember that the first state to allow same-sex marriage in the United States was Massachusetts. Based on a 2003 ruling, people started marrying there in 2004. So we're not yet 10 years into this. But since that time, there's been a tremendous change. And I think a lot of it is the same kind of phenomenon that has manifested itself elsewhere in the gay rights movement, which is basically as people become more familiar with an idea, as they get to know more out gay people, it becomes less threatening than it was when it once seemed like a crazy, wacky kind of notion that struck people as implausible. And I think it's that familiarity, it's the fact that people now in 9 states are marrying, and I think society's getting more used to it. And, you know, things haven't changed too much for heterosexuals in their own marriages. There's been obviously a debate about whether allowing same-sex couples to marry will harm the institution of marriage. And that's been a big part of the public debate. And I think what people see when they look around is they don't really see the evidence for that in any clear way, and I think that's part of what's driving public opinion.
Now, the court is today looking at Proposition 8 in California, tomorrow Defense of Marriage Act. Is there some reason they took both of these cases in at the same time?
Yeah, it's also a good question. This is a complicated set of issues now that have arisen with these two cases, and let's first make sure everybody understands the difference between them. The California case involves Proposition 8, which is similar, a little bit different circumstances led to it, but similar to what you have in Wisconsin, which is a law that bans same-sex marriages. And the constitutional question there is whether, notwithstanding what California's voters have said, same-sex couples should be allowed to marry in California because what the voters did was unconstitutional. The issue in the federal case is different. The Federal Defense of Marriage Act, the part of it that's been challenged here, basically says that the federal government cannot recognize any same-sex marriages that a state may choose to grant, even though the federal government, as a matter of course, automatically recognizes marriages that a state considers valid in every other circumstance. So if the Defense of Marriage Act were struck down, what it would mean is that the federal government would start recognizing same-sex marriages, but it would not obligate any state to newly grant same-sex marriages itself. It's all about things like federal tax and Social Security benefits and about 1,000 federal programs. So the two cases present different sides of the issue. If DOMA is struck down, the court would be taking a step in the direction of marriage equality, but it would not actually be issuing a ruling that would require any state to marry same-sex couples. So I think they took both of them. Number one, they present different faces of the issue. Number two, it's very typical when a federal statute has been struck down that the court is very likely to take a look at that case. So that covers the DOMA case. And so a lot of people weren't sure they were also going to take the California case. And, you know, it's anybody's guess exactly why they took it. We'll know in a few months.
And when it comes to the California case, my understanding is the court could rule, and it would have nationwide implications. The court could rule concerning a certain number of states. The court could rule and have it just be applicable to the state of California.
That's right. We have a range of outcomes on the federal case. We have at least five. On the California case, we have at least five outcomes that we can sketch out. One is the first one you mentioned, which is what some people call the 50-state solution. And that is the broadest possible ruling, and frankly, that is the ruling being sought by the star-studded legal team of Ted Olson and David Boies. They are swinging for the fences, as it were, and asking for a 50-state ruling that every state in this country, as a matter of constitutional law, must allow same-sex couples to marry. That would be the broadest ruling. The one less broad would be that any state that, as California does, grants same-sex couples all the rights and responsibilities of marriage but doesn't permit them to call it a marriage, puts those couples into a separate institution called civil union, domestic partnership, something like that. But it's comprehensive in the sense that it has all the rights and responsibilities that state marriage law gives to couples. That would be now, it's actually now a 9-state solution because Colorado just passed comprehensive civil unions. That would say all those states, which, like California, grant all those rights but don't let couples call it marriage, those are all unconstitutional. Then there is, as you mentioned, the California-only solution, which is to look, really get into the weeds with the particular facts of the California case, including the fact that a state Supreme Court had granted same-sex couples the right to marry, and then the voters took that away at the polls and say that that is its own situation. Then there is another solution which involves some complicated procedural questions where the court might hold that no one in this case has what lawyers call standing to challenge it in the Supreme Court, and that's because the state, the governor and the attorney general in California, agree with the plaintiffs that the law, that Prop 8 is unconstitutional. So that's another ruling. And then the fifth option the court has is to uphold Prop 8 and say it's fully constitutional for a state to choose whether or not to allow same-sex couples to marry. So we've got five different
possibilities. Goodness gracious.
Yeah.
Why is it that Olson and Boys have decided to go for the whole enchilada?
Yeah. Well, I think they got into this case thinking that the time was right for a historic challenge that they liken to other landmark cases. I think they believe that the Supreme Court's constitutional law supports that kind of a ruling, and I think they are not persuaded, as many lawyers for the gay rights movement have been persuaded, that the time is not right for the broadest solution. Now, with public opinion changing as quickly as it has, including since this case was filed in 2009, I don't know whether supporters of same-sex marriage are necessarily as skeptical as they once were of a 50-state solution, although I think many people still think that the timing is not quite ready for that, given how many states in this country still disallow same-sex marriage.
And who's arguing in favor of Proposition 8?
Yeah. Proposition 8, because the governor and the attorney general did not choose to defend it, Proposition 8 is being defended by the ballot sponsors, the group that brought it to the ballot, that went through, got signatures, ran the campaign, and was successful in getting Prop 8 passed in 2008. And they've also got a very accomplished lawyer in Charles Cooper, who's arguing for them.
And they're arguing the good reason to draw the line is what?
Well, they have a couple of different arguments. One argument is there's this idea that has surfaced in the context of same-sex marriage that boils down to what people call responsible procreation. That's kind of their main argument, and here's how that argument goes. The argument is that a core purpose of marriage is to channel procreation into the institution of marriage so that children will have two parents, will have both of their biological parents, and that if society doesn't present an institution like marriage to do that, there's a chance that procreation will, as it were, become irresponsible and take place outside of marriage. Now, the question, so that's their main, that's the function of marriage, they say, and same-sex couples, because they cannot biologically procreate with one another. Clearly, they can raise children, and many, many same-sex couples do, but they can't biologically procreate with one another. They can't have an accidental pregnancy in the same way that a heterosexual couple can. The defenders of Prop 8 say, therefore, it's constitutional, given that purpose, for the state to bar same-sex couples. Now, I think the response to that argument is there's really no connection between allowing same-sex couples into marriage and that purpose. In other words, whether someone, sees marriage, some heterosexual couple sees marriage as important because of procreation, is not going to be affected by whether or not same-sex couples are in or are out. So that's their main argument, and that's the response to it. A lot of this is going to be determined based on a very arcane but really important idea in the law, which is what is the standard of review that the court will apply to look at this case. And I don't want to get too technical here, but basically, most of the time when government draws lines and establishes lines, say they say that a truck that weighs up to, so many thousand pounds can pay this fee to use a highway, but a heavier one has to pay a higher fee. Most of the time when a court looks at that line, they use a very, very deferential standard. They basically let the government do what it wants. They don't get in the government's business. It's called rational basis, and it's a very forgiving, easy standard for the government to meet. But whenever there is a hint of prejudice or traditional discrimination or an idea that a group is not getting a fair shake in the political process, then the court, what's called heightened scrutiny, or applies a more demanding test, or uses the rational basis test in a more demanding way. Really, the bottom line there is simply that whether or not that responsible procreation argument flies, or any of the other justifications that they've also tossed in, whether or not the court buys them, will be all wrapped up with this question of how closely do they look at the state's reason? How searching is the review?
And can you look at, because there would be a lot of holes in this argument, heterosexual responsible procreation, there are a lot of problems in that area, aren't there?
There are a lot of problems in that area. I mean, there's a question whether marriage actually, as an empirical matter, serves that purpose. There's a question whether same-sex, you know, couples' behavior have any impact on that, you know, and there's a lot of interesting data around about the fact that states that have legalized same-sex marriage are no more or less likely to have lots of, you know, out-of-wedlock births. Some of them, in fact, have lower divorce rates, and, you know, the data doesn't really add up on that argument. And I think to kind of state the argument clearly is to see where its holes are, as you say. But once again, if the court is not inclined to take a close look at this, it almost lets the government offer any reason it wants, even if it's hypothetical and doesn't stand up under analysis. Now, I think it's, you know, I think the court is going to, if it gets to the merits in that case, if it doesn't dismiss it on procedural grounds, I think it's going to look more closely at how that justification really works. And one more thing that I think is important to say, and for people in Wisconsin to understand, that there's a set of arguments that people sometimes make about why a state might choose to disallow same-sex marriage that California, or someone arguing in favor of the state of California, like these ballot sponsors, in this case, they're not well positioned to make them. And that is because California law grants very comprehensive domestic partnership rights to same-sex couples. That means as to issues relating to children, adoption, and really every other aspect of state law, same-sex couples have the rights that opposite-sex couples have in California. So if you want to talk about, you know, issues about parenting that opponents of same-sex marriage try to argue, you can't even really make those arguments in California because the state already grants full and comprehensive parenting rights to same-sex couples. So you're reduced to looking for something else.
Now that's interesting. And finally, for me, before we go to our phone calls, we have a number of people who want to speak with you. Why are the arguments so short? This is such a historic hearing, yeah. And it's only a couple hours today and tomorrow.
Yeah, it is interesting. That's kind of the way the court did it. Actually, tomorrow's case is twice as long as today's, and I don't know quite what to read into that. They've allowed their usual 1 hour per case. That's the usual Supreme Court guideline for oral argument today. Tomorrow, it's an hour and 50 minutes. And that, I think, mostly has to do with certain aspects of the procedural issue in the federal case. I won't be surprised if the Chief Justice, who's in charge of keeping time, lets this run overtime, because I think the justices are going to have a lot of questions, so I think it will be longer than an hour. But that's kind of the Supreme Court protocol, and it's a very traditional institution, so they tend to stick to it.
Two phone calls momentarily. We're talking about gay marriage, same-sex marriage today and tomorrow. The Supreme Court is having historic hearings on two different appeals. One is Proposition 8 in California. Tomorrow will be the Defense of Marriage Act. Our guest is Professor Jane Schachter. She is Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Curriculum at Stanford Law School. Here's how you reach us. One line open at this moment, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Scott in Peshtigo. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I have just a couple of quick points on the question. I'm somewhat ambivalent still on same-sex marriage. You ask me one day how I feel, I have one opinion. You ask me another day, I have another opinion. It vacillates back and forth, probably more when it comes to against from a religious standpoint, and then for from a civil rights standpoint. I find it very odd that because I'm married to a woman that I actually receive benefits that other people don't because they're not married to her. It just, to me, there seems something inherently wrong in a system that I benefit and other people don't. So I understand that point. My question is from a civil rights standpoint, and this is a true technicality, but nobody's ever been able to really answer it for me. From a civil rights standpoint, if we define marriage as, you know, a man and a woman, two women, two men, technically, couldn't we then say from a civil rights standpoint that if you wanted to have two wives, you could? If we're going to open this up to actually my civil rights, from a technical standpoint, couldn't we do that? And that's my first question. And my
All right, let's get that question answered. Professor Schachter.
Yeah, it's a very good question, honestly, and it's one that comes up a lot in the debate. What is the difference between a claim for same-sex marriage and a claim for a constitutional right to polygamy, to have more than one spouse? I think the best I can say about that is really there is no protection in the federal constitution that the Supreme Court has ever articulated for polygamy. In fact, the cases that have been decided go in the other direction. Whereas the cases on the right to a relationship with a same-sex partner, the right not to have that criminalized, the fact that equal protection applies to sexual orientation, have established the predicate for the claim to same-sex marriage. And, of course, you know, there is in the Constitution, the Supreme Court has recognized, it's not in the language of the Constitution, but it's long recognized, a right to marry, and it's always defined that as two persons. Now, if there were a social movement that took hold and polygamy really began to look different to people, you know, 50 years from now, would that change? I can't say it would never change, but I would say that based on current law, there's really no basis for making that leap.
Scott?
Yeah, oh, good. I'm glad because every time I bring it up, somebody says it's a red herring, but I'm actually legitimately interested in the answer, and that's a great answer. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure.
My other quick question is, or my comment more than anything else, is I know the state's attorney general isn't defending Prop 8, and I believe Holder isn't defending DOMA. Is that typical? Because I'm wondering what the uproar would be if, let's say, John Ashcroft or Alberto Gonzalez decided they didn't want to defend Roe v. Wade in front of the Supreme Court. I mean, is this common that the federal, you know, the attorney general decides he's not going to defend a federal law?
Yeah, it's not common, but it's also not unheard of. So almost every administration at some point will part company with a, you know, with maybe an agency's position on something, and more rarely, but again, not unheard of, a statute. And it's an issue where the attorney general has the final discretion to make a call whether to defend a statute. This sometimes happens on the state level as well, where an attorney general will take a particular position about a state law. And at that point, what happens is what happened here. The Obama administration, when Attorney General Holder said they would not be defending DOMA, made clear that they would continue to enforce it and that Congress would be given the opportunity, if they wanted to mount a defense, the different houses of Congress to do so, and the House stepped in. So there's an alternative defense being mounted. The measure is still being enforced. So it's rare, but it's there's certainly precedent for it.
Thanks very much, Scott, for the call. And we should spend, before we go back to phone calls, we haven't talked much about DOMA, so why don't you tell us the story of Edith Windsor?
Yeah. So Edie Windsor is the plaintiff in the case the court chose to review. There are actually a number of cases before them involving challenges to DOMA. DOMA was passed in 1996. It was 3 years after, as I mentioned early on, that the Hawaii Supreme Court looked like it was about to legalize same-sex marriage but didn't, and it was part of the first wave of backlash against that decision, at a time when public opinion was nowhere on same-sex marriage. And Congress basically said, whatever any state chooses to do, the federal government will not recognize as married any couple except one man and one woman. And it passed overwhelmingly. It was signed by President Clinton. That means that when the government administers something like the estate tax, any number of Social Security benefits, all kinds of things, it will not treat a same-sex couple who is married in any of the 9 states in the District of Columbia that now permit same-sex marriage, it will not treat that couple as married, even though it otherwise automatically defers and accepts whatever state's definition of marriage is and doesn't question whether a couple is married. The upshot of that for Edie Windsor had a 40-some-year relationship with Thea Speier, her lifelong partner. In the last decade or so of their life together, Dr. Spire, developed multiple sclerosis, and Edie was her principal caretaker. They were married in Canada in 2007, I think it was, or something like that, before before Thea died. And when Thea died, she had a house that passed under her will to Edie. And Edie was hit with an estate tax of $365,000 that she would not have had to pay had she been married to a man. It was just, it's just a flat-out distinction. And, you know, Edie is in her 80s. She's a widow. She doesn't have a lot of assets. So this is a, this is, this is a, this is a big-ticket item for her to have to pay this tax. So she is suing to get the tax, to get the tax back.
Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. It seems to me that the popular arguments against marriage equality have often focused around the issue of sameness. And by that I mean, is this the same kind of fight as civil rights fights for blacks or women or other things? And I think really what I want your guests to tell me is whether or not it doesn't make more sense for those arguing for marriage equality to really focus on the nature of contract law, the traditions of contract law, because it seems to me a society has to have extremely good reasons to choose a group of people to bar from making certain kinds of contracts. At one time, blacks were essentially barred from having anything which could really be defined as marriage. I mean, you could be put up on the auction block and your family separated from your children. And more recently, we've changed our law with regard to the ability of women to make contracts independently from their marital status or their situation. And I think that contract law that says law governs the oral and written agreements between people for goods and services, money, properties, as you've just mentioned, and affiliations is really where this argument for marriage equality rests if it's not dismissed on procedurals or technicalities.
Yeah, it's an interesting argument. I have a couple of thoughts about that. One is that, as you pointed out, it was an important part of the Reconstruction Amendments after the Civil War to establish the right of everyone to make and enter into contracts. And that has been actually absorbed into and assimilated into the idea of civil rights law. So to the extent we think of marriage as a contract, the right of everyone equally to enter into contracts is kind of part of the corpus of civil rights law. The other way to think about it, though, I think, is that people can, you know, an opponent of marriage equality, I think, would say people can enter into any contract they want with each other, and they can decide how to distribute their property, and they can decide, you know, what they want their arrangement to be with each other, and they can commit to each other. But whether or not the state has to recognize that and call it marriage is still a separate question. The contract itself is separate from what you call it. Now, the truth is, partners cannot accomplish by contract everything that marriage bestows on them. I think Edie and Thea are a perfect example of that. There was no question that Thea wanted Edie to get her house. She got her house. But the issue of whether she'd have to pay this enormous tax that another couple would not have to, is that a matter of contract or is that a matter of state recognition? Is that a matter of state tax policy? You begin to see the lines get a little blurry.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rich, very much for your call. If Proposition 8 is deemed unconstitutional by the court, then does it nullify Defense of Marriage Act?
No, it does not. These are two independent things. But there is a connection between them. That is, there are equal protection challenges being asserted against both laws. And what I mean by that is both challengers are invoking the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, and they are both saying the government, the federal government in the case of DOMA, the California government in the case of Prop 8, California's voters, really, in the case of Prop 8, does not have a good reason to draw this line. So a ruling in one on based on equality principles could well have implications for the other, and that may be why the court is looking at them together, because they relate to each other. But a ruling in one would not automatically invalidate the other, because they are different, to some degree, they're differently justified by those who are defending them. So there's no saying that a ruling on one would necessarily take care of the other.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Supreme Court is taking up historic cases on same-sex marriage, looking at Proposition 8 in California today. Tomorrow, the Defense of Marriage Act. The hearings have begun as we speak and will last today until about, about an hour and a half or so. Our guest this hour, who really knows these issues, is Jane Schachter. She is professor of law and associate dean for curriculum at Stanford Law School. Our number is 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you right now. Clyde in Tish Mills. Hi, Clyde.
Good morning. My domestic partner and I, Jerry, have been together for over 35, almost 36 years. We are domestic partners under the Wisconsin law and have 43 defined rights. Written into the state and national laws are over 1,600 laws that favor and a few give responsibilities for straight married couples. So 43 versus 1,600, that's a little different. Divorced people, straight people, have more rights than we do. So this has to be decided on a national basis, and hopefully the Supreme Court will get it right. I have very little faith in them, but I really hope that they do.
Thank you, Clyde, for your call. Professor Schachter.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Clyde raises a very compelling argument, which is that same-sex couples around the country are hurt by this exclusion in very tangible ways. And if you look at the map around the country, it's very much state by state. We have a situation where in many states in this country, same-sex couples have no rights whatsoever, not even the 43 that Clyde was talking about, all the way to 9 states in the District of Columbia which allow same-sex couples to marry. So we have a real patchwork map out there. And the question is, what is the justification for all these differences in state laws? And that really goes to one of the things that I think is going to be at the heart of the arguments today, which is, should the Supreme Court allow states to decide on their own and to allow state variability? Sometimes we talk about states as laboratories of democracy and of experimentation, and we like the kind of variability that comes along with one state having one policy, which is more responsive to local preferences, and one state having another. Now, the 14th Amendment said, when it comes to civil rights and equal protection, arguments for local variation go out the window. Mm. We have a uniform standard, right? So I think that's one way the court might look at it. On the other hand, really, when we look at things, I think the United States Supreme Court does not typically get that far out of society and where society has come to be. Now, if we look at public opinion has moved so rapidly, I think the justices will see that, and we talked about that early on, about how that might shape the way they look at the question of why the states are excluding same-sex couples. But on the other hand, we still have, 37 states with bans on same-sex marriage, 41 that don't allow in one fashion or another same-sex marriage. So I think the court is going to be cautious when it looks out at that map and may be a little less responsive to Clyde's argument because it's afraid of backlash, it's afraid perhaps that the country isn't ready for this, and that it's afraid of the implications for the institution in issuing a ruling that controversial. Whether a court should think about any of those things is a very legitimate question, and I imagine Clyde would think that's not the court's business to think what the results of its decision will be. It should just decide it based on what it thinks the law is. But I think all of that will be swirling around in this decision. When the Supreme Court in 1967...
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going there.
Yeah, struck down a ban on interracial marriage in the Loving versus Virginia case. There were maybe, I don't remember the exact number, 12 or 15 states, 16 states that still banned interracial marriage, heavily concentrated in the South. Now, it shouldn't be a numbers game where the court kind of counts up the number of states that have moved. But the truth is the justices are part of the society that's around them. They don't sit in a vacuum chamber and are unaffected by what's going on around them. So I think that, you know, the fact that so many states still ban it will enter into the way the court kind of frames and sees the issue, although it will not dispose of the issue. It will not be the thing that decides the question, but it will provide some of the background for the justices.
Does, though, Loving versus Virginia inform this case in some ways?
Well, it does, in the sense that it's a central part of the argument of those challenging, particularly Prop 8. There are two different kinds of arguments that that legal and constitutional proponents of same-sex marriage make. One is that there is this fundamental right to marry, and that's grounded in one part of the 14th Amendment. The other is that there's an equal protection issue, which is grounded in another part of the 14th Amendment. If the court were to find that there is a fundamental right to marry that extends to same-sex couples, just like two heterosexual people, that two people of the same sex have that same fundamental right to marry one another, that would be the ruling with nationwide implications, and that is one part of Loving versus Virginia. The other part of the Loving case, though, is an equal protection holding, which is to say it is discriminatory based on race to say that someone cannot marry someone of the opposite, of a different race. Now, does that have implications for same-sex marriage? Well, the court has traditionally treated race as the most suspicious classification of all, and it triggers maximal skepticism and the harshest scrutiny by the court whenever the government is drawing distinctions based on race. Now, in this case, they're not drawing distinctions based on race. They're drawing distinctions based on sexual orientation or perhaps based on gender, and those have their own... The court has their own way of looking at those things, which is not as maximal in terms of the level of scrutiny, but still sets off some alarm bells about traditional discrimination, prejudice, unfairness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not identical, but it's in the ballpark. Let's mm-hmm. say that.
The U.S. Supreme Court has begun hearings, 2 days of hearings, arguments in cases involving gay marriage. We're talking about those cases this hour of the program. Our phone number, one line is open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org, or leave messages. We're interested in reading them, even if we can't get to all of them on the air, but it's interesting to go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and read your comments during the show or after the show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, a completely different topic. The author of 500 Places, and these places are all over the world. I did some great sofa surfing of places to go, at least in my mind's eye. 500 Places to Take Your Kids Before They Grow Up. Back to phone calls. Ellen is next in Brookfield. Hello, Ellen.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, just on the subject of gay marriage, destroying marriage as we know it and all of that business. Anecdotally, I can tell about my family. I come from a large Catholic family, 9 children. 3 of us have been married long-term, over 35, 40 years for a couple of us, 20 years for another. 2 have been divorced and remarried twice. 1 is still married to the man she was married to second time and living with another man. She still gets to claim her husband's Social Security and his pension benefits and all of that business. 2 have been divorced, 2 never married. Most of us who are married, except for 1, have children, and the divorced ones have children. I married into an Episcopal family. five children in that family. Everybody has been married at least 20 years or longer, 50 years, 65 years. I was married 34 years before my husband died. We have a gay couple, our nephews, who have been married or been together 22 years. This family is just hyper-dedicated to family, to community, to their church, to politics. We have been harmed, not in the least, by the gay marriage. There's cousins who are a gay couple, and the two of them, they have two sons together, very, as far as we can see so far, well-adjusted. This notion, at least, is not borne out in my family, that gay couples will destroy family life as we know it. I also, while I was listening, was thinking this thought that perhaps what we need to do is have the benefits not follow multiple marriages. You know, if marriage is just between the two people for a lifetime, for the benefit of children, you know, blah, 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 then, you know, then maybe we should allow couples who choose to stay together to accrue the benefits and those who choose to not.
Professor Schachter.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. And I think it highlights this issue of what exactly, you know, just think about the name of the federal law, the Defense of Marriage Act. What exactly is it being defended against? And, you know, I mentioned earlier that in some states that permit same-sex marriage, the divorce rate is actually lower. So there's really no kind of strong correlation that I think can be shown between one and the other. And I think that the real question in this case is whether that will be good enough. Of course, we have very high divorce rates, and there's all kinds of ideas about how to bring that down. And ideas that, you know, children in single-parent families don't do as well as children in two-parent families. And, you know, that's an interesting thing because, for example, in California, this is related to the Prop 8 litigation. It's an odd thing, isn't it, to say that families with two parents, that is better for children, and it's better for the parents to be married. But for all the same-sex couples in California who are raising children, their children can't get the benefit of that. So there's some very strange aspects of this argument. And, you know, do we want to, your caller was suggesting an incentive to keep people married longer. Do we want to create an incentive back to that responsible procreation idea for heterosexual people to marry one another? And the price for that should be paid by the children of same-sex couples. The two just don't really fit together logically.
Thanks, Ellen, for the call. Mike in Sun Prairie. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I believe that the law should be voted within each state, not the federal government. I also believe that like gays in the military, I support that because if a man is gay or a woman is gay and is willing to give their life for their country, and it's a heterosexual woman or man not willing to do that, then they should be given that right. But I don't believe the president and the government, or even the Supreme Court for that matter, qualified to be making a national review of this case. It should be done state by state, and that's what I believe.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for the call.
Well, I think, again, we're back to the 14th Amendment. And what the 14th Amendment did, and there's, you know, there's a lot of different opinions on this, so I respect the caller's opinion about this because the line is not clear in the Constitution. The line that is clear in the Constitution is that every state is subject to the obligation to provide equal protection to its citizens. And anything that falls within the scope of equal protection, that is the end of state-by-state, you know, federalism kinds of ideas. So the whole question is whether this falls within the zone of equal protection. And that's what we're about to find out, whether or not, you know, drawing a line between who can marry and who can't violates the idea of equal protection.
Have you been, I don't know if you do this kind of thing or not, but a lot of people do, trying to read the justices' minds on these issues, what they may have said, what they may have written?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the conventional wisdom based on reading past opinions is that Justice Kennedy, as he often is, will be the crucial vote in this case. Justice Kennedy is often the swing voter on the Supreme Court these days, and he's written the two critical opinions that the Supreme Court has put out during his time on the court on gay rights, both favoring gay rights. One of them struck down a ban on consensual sodomy between same-sex couples. The other struck down a very broadly worded Colorado ballot measure, which denied anti-discrimination protection in laws banning discrimination in the state to gays and lesbians. And he wrote the latter opinion about the Colorado thing was a equal protection opinion, and the Lawrence opinion had to do with the sodomy opinion had to do with what we call due process of law. And so all eyes are on him. Now, very recently, he was, I believe, visiting Sacramento here in California, and he said, you know, there are too many issues being kicked over to 9 unelected justices, not enough breathing room left for the democratic process. And I think immediately people started wondering, was he talking about marriage? I mean, what's interesting is that there's some really important other cases up there this term, and one of them has to do with a critical provision of the Voting Rights Act, which, of course, was passed through the democratic process through Congress and has been reauthorized a couple of times. And many people expect the Supreme Court, and again, Justice Kennedy would be a critical vote here, to strike down a piece of the Voting Rights Act. So when I hear him talking about letting the democratic process run its course, I'm wondering, is he talking about same-sex marriage? Is he talking about the Voting Rights Act? Because, you know, this is an issue about this line between what we let legislatures and the populace do and what courts should do really tends to move around based on how people see the issue itself.
Right. Connie in Madison, hi.
Hi. I'm very struck by how emotional this issue, of course, is, and I remind myself of Jonathan Swift. He said, you can't reason someone out of a position that they weren't reasoned into. But I find this issue essentially a quite conservative one. That is to say that those couples wishing to marry are wishing to join an essentially conservative, law-abiding, and law-enforceable set of obligations to each other. And to my sense, we should be rooting for those couples who choose to take on these obligations because they are, in fact, stabilizing a portion of society and regularizing it. I don't know if that's been raised yet today.
It's an interesting argument, and it really highlights, I think, the role of Ted Olson in this litigation. As your caller and listeners may know, he was George Bush's lawyer in the 2000 election. He's a conservative Republican traditionally, and he is spearheading this challenge. And his argument about marriage is basically like that. It's a traditional institution that kind of recognizes the commitment between two people and stabilizes the life of their children. So to the extent you know, wouldn't you want more people to do that and have that opportunity rather than fewer, he has kind of cast it as a conservative issue.
Thank you, Connie. Interesting point. Ivory in Milwaukee, about a minute left, everyone. Hi, Ivory.
Hi. I was just calling with a comment that marriage is meant for procreation. A man and a woman is meant to come together to have children to further the human race. And you just can't do that with a homosexual couple.
Well, you know, it's a fair point. I think it's something the justices are going to talk about. But there are couples who are infertile. There are couples who are too old to procreate. There are couples who adopt children. There are couples who choose not to procreate. So that is certainly one function of marriage, but it's not the function across the board.
Well, thank you, Professor Schachter. You really know these issues. I'm just very impressed. It's been such an informative hour.
Oh, well, thank you. I enjoyed talking with you and your callers.
Thank you. We enjoyed having you as our guest, guiding us through all of this. Historic day. U.S. Supreme Court has begun hearings of 2 days of arguments in cases involving same-sex marriage. They are looking at an issue that, as I said, is historic. I guess I'm overusing that phrase, but it is really a big issue that popular opinion has been moving in favor of this, and it will be fascinating to see how the court rules, which should happen sometime in June. They are currently hearing Proposition 8 arguments as we speak. Thanks to Amanda Magnus and Katie Mattson for producing this hour, and we thank our guest. Professor Jane Schachter is a leading expert on statutory interpretation and legislative process, constitutional law, and sexual orientation law. She is a professor of law and associate dean for curriculum at Stanford Law School. News is coming up. We'll return.